And hello, everybody. This is Paul Richard Price with the Paul Richard Price Show on BBS Radio. And I want to thank everybody at BBS for the transition here. It has been smooth from my previous network now to BBS. And I'd like to introduce my guest, Dr. John Brandenburg, physicist, who works for Orbital Technologies Incorporated. Has written two different books, one on life and death on Mars, and the second one dealing with the unified field theory. And Dr. Brandenburg is well known for his controversial stance on the subject of Mars. Was Mars nuked? And if so, what happened? What kind of proof do we have? And what does that bid for the future, not only of Mars and Mars exploration, but also of mankind in general? Are we the Martians? And Dr. Brandenburg, I'd like to thank you again for being on my show.
Oh, great to be here, Paul. Thank you.
Okay, let me remind my guests, tonight, if any of you want to call in, the toll-free number is 888-627-6008. And what I'd like to do is wait until the 30 minutes into the show for any phone calls to come in and give Dr. Brandenburg an opportunity to speak live on the show. This will be part one of a two-part series. And Dr. Brandenburg, thank you again for being on the show. And let me ask you, you and I have a mutual friend, Paul Murad, who's a engineer and a former rocket scientist for NASA and worked in with the Department of Defense and other commercial ventures. And he was the one who told me about you. Now, you've been on Coast to Coast AM before, is that correct?
Right.
Okay,
I was on it before it was even Coast to Coast.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, you know, back in the past, you have made controversial stances, which in effect could have made you and did make you the laughingstock of the scientific community.
Yes.
But you still... But you still stood by your stance. Now, can
but I'm the one laughing now.
obviously.
No, actually, anyone who knows me as a scientist and has worked with me, like Paul Murad, knows that I'm basically a rather conservative character. I don't leap before I have looked and studied it very carefully. And when I take my shot, I make sure I've got all the evidence on my side.
Well, could you at first tell us a wee bit about your book? Who is publishing your book and why you are taking the stance that you believe Mars, number one, had a cataclysmic disaster sometime in its past, and evidence that a very large hydrogen bomb was blown up above Mars, salting it, so to speak, to where life could not exist.
Yeah, I would say that I have not claimed there was a giant hydrogen bomb that was dropped on Mars. I'll just simply say that the paper I presented at a scientific conference, the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, one of the most prestigious conferences in the community. Basically, I presented the fact there had been a large nuclear event on Mars, and I tried to explain that as a natural nuclear reactor. Now, in Africa, there were natural nuclear reactors that operated in uranium deposits about a billion years ago when the uranium was much more enriched in uranium-235, which is the easiest uranium to fission. And what happened was groundwater would creep into these uranium deposits, and little miniature nuclear reactors would start operating. They were about as big as a your kitchen. And basically, they would get really hot and drive the water out, and then it would shut down, just like a natural reactor, like a nuclear reactor on Earth is supposed to do. American nuclear reactors are designed so if they lose their cooling water, they shut down automatically. On Mars, apparently, the nuclear reactor was much, much larger, and it not only ran on uranium, it apparently ran on uranium-233, which is made from thorium. Thorium and uranium are naturally mixed in nature. And so this reaction was much larger and apparently went out of control and exploded in a massive explosion that spread radioactive debris over the entire surface. And the evidence for this is we find that there's a thin radioactive layer radiating from a central hotspot on Mars, and the hotspot, their color maps in my book, Life and Death on Mars, that show where the location of the epicenter of this explosion was, the ground zero. And also the Martian atmosphere is loaded with what are called radiogenic inert gases. These are isotopes that are on Earth are the product of radioactive decay or explosion, especially xenon-129, which is created in nuclear explosions on Earth, and also argon-40, which is from the decay of radioactive potassium. Potassium generally gets radioactive whenever you have a big nuclear event, and it has a billion-year half-life, so it has a long memory for such an event. And these things are radioactive potassium, radioactive thorium, radiate from this big hot spot on Mars, and the atmosphere is dominated by the results of this radioactive event, xenon-129, the argon-40. And I've worked in defense for a long time. I know what the effects of nuclear weapons are, and I consulted experts and showed them the evidence. In fact, the first place we reported this when we found it was the Pentagon. They have a Mars desk. We found out where it was, and we reported this to them. And they were astonished. Of course, they can't go on the record. But the fact there was a large nuclear explosion on Mars is kind of a no-brainer based on the evidence. Now, the government is uncomfortable with this and has basically poo-pooed the evidence. But you would expect them to do that. Not only did the U.S. government do it, but the Russian government did it too. So I'm doubly honored by having both governments say, move along, folks, there's nothing here to see.
Okay, so in effect, you can say, quote-unquote, you be the man. Okay, you're the guy who, the go-to guy.
Well, yes, right now at least.
And, you know, we're looking at the particulars dealing with, you said, a natural nuclear reaction.
Well, that was the easiest way to explain it, given the fact that there were natural nuclear reactors on Earth. Several scientists commented on seeing my paper. They said, well, if there were natural nuclear reactors on Earth, there had to have been natural nuclear reactors on Mars. The same laws of physics apply there. The fascinating thing about this, though, is that if it was a natural nuclear reactor, which is the easiest way to explain this, it's the simplest hypothesis, then it would have left a large crater. But instead, there's no crater. There's just a broad, shallow depression. It looks like whatever happened went off in midair. And that is much more difficult to explain in terms of some kind of natural process. A natural nuclear reactor, which could have happened on Mars and probably did, if it exploded, would have left a large crater. Instead, we just have a broad, shallow depression in the area, where in the center of the hotspot, radioactive hotspot on Mars.
Well,
so that's a puzzle.
Interesting fact. Oh, go ahead, please.
Well, one guy commented when I showed him all this. He says, "Well, it looks like an airburst," which is a terminology for nuclear weapons strategy, which means you blow up the bomb in midair. So it doesn't, it spreads its blast over a wider area. So it almost looks like something burst in midair in the Martian atmosphere rather than in the soil which is where you would expect a natural nuclear reactor. The natural nuclear reactors in Africa, of course, happened underground. If that had happened on Mars, you would expect a large crater, but instead there's just a broad, shallow depression. Now, it's possible a crater formed and then filled in because the surface is molten after this event, but it's very peculiar. So we have evidence for a very large nuclear event, but if you look at the ground zero, there isn't the crater you would expect. The evidence in terms of radio nuclides is very strong, and this happened about a quarter of a billion years ago, perhaps. So the evidence is very strong that something happened, but what exactly happened is difficult to pin down. That's why I said you would have to almost consider the possibility that someone had nuked Mars. In fact, people refer to this as Mars as Alderaan from Star Wars. Remember, the planet Alderaan was destroyed by the Death Star. And the reason somebody said, why would anyone nuke Mars? And I said, because Tatooine is far too remote to be a good example. That's quoting Governor Tarkin from Star Wars.
Well, do you mind if I could bring this up?
Sure.
It's kind of suspicious where that burst originated.
Yes.
And we're talking about the Cydonia region.
That's right. Now, it's close to Cydonia.
Or close to Cydonia. Now, you were one of the team members who looked at the evidence originally from NASA over 30 years ago from the Viking.
Worked with Vince DiPietro and Dick Hoagland.
And the thing about it is, not only do you see the face structure on Mars, but you see a what looks to be a archaeological treasure of artifacts around the area, buildings and such.
A pyramid.
A pyramid as well, that can only be explained by intelligence that built these things. Now, the big question is, were there Martians? And if so, who in the heck was fighting them? And why?
Those, Paul, are very important questions. We have to go up to Mars, and we have to send teams of archaeologists and military people to examine the remains up there and figure out what happened. And that can only be done by people, boots on the ground. People say, oh, you can send all these robots. Well, there's nothing like having people on the ground. And our survival could depend on finding out what happened on Mars. We don't want it happening here. And somebody asked, well, why would, if there were Martians, why would they blow themselves up like this? Well, it doesn't look like somebody blew themselves up. It looks like, it looks like something entered the atmosphere of Mars and exploded several kilometers up in the atmosphere, and it entered from outer space. That means it probably came from someplace other than Mars. So you must understand that, like the title of the book, these are matters of life and death. We must go to Mars and find out what happened. And the fact that there was apparently a civilization on Mars, and we have, myself, Vince DiPietro, and Greg Molinar published a superb scientific article called The Cydonian Hypothesis. We laid everything out, the evidence for a past biosphere on Mars. And that was in 1991, where we didn't have as much evidence as we have now. I was the first person to propose an ocean on Mars, a paleo ocean. And we did that based on the Cydonia investigation, where we discovered that Cydonia and another archaeological site, a place called Utopia, that has two faces, that it's apparently laid on the shoreline of this large ocean in the north of Mars. Now, the ocean of Mars is on the youngest part of Mars. It's not on the ancient. If you understand Mars geology, the ancient part of Mars is the south. It's the high, rugged highlands of Mars. It's covered with craters. The craters have a lot of water channels mixed in with them. But that's all very ancient. It looks like the moon. The north of Mars looks almost Earth-like, has very few craters. That means it's very young. That means it's geologic forces like wind and water have actually erased all the craters and new ones had to form. And that's where the old ocean bed is. That ocean lasted for most of Mars' geologic history, probably up until about 500 million years ago. And if you had liquid water, a liquid water ocean, you had life. That's my contention. If you have water, liquid water, an ocean, then you have basically Earth-like conditions, and you had life. You had stuff swimming in that ocean, and perhaps rowing boats over the ocean.
Well, do you mind if I could bring up something? You talked about it before previously in this interview, about the Department of Defense having a Mars.
A Mars desk?
Mars desk.
Well,
yes.
If they're doing their job, we have told the Department of Defense everything we have found. And, of course, they have their own ways of finding out things. So, based on that, I would admit we found there was a Mars desk at the Pentagon. I'm speaking, I don't know if it's actually housed directly in the Pentagon, but there was a Mars desk in the Defense Department, and we reported this stuff to them because we were good patriots, Vince DiPietro and I. And they were grateful. We said, well, we have to go to Mars before the Russians do. This is back in the Cold War, remember. The goal was to get to Mars and find out where the treasure was buried there before the Russians could. And the same goes for any other country like People's Republic of China. We have to get there ahead of them. We have to find out what happened on Mars. And we also have to find out if there was an advanced if the culture on Mars advanced to high levels of technology, and is there high technology buried in the ruins? These are things the people at the Mars desk at the Pentagon worry about.
So, in other words, when they deny publicly that they're doing any research in UFOs and extraterrestrial life, they are lying straight through their teeth.
Well, Uncle Sammy views it that he doesn't have to tell everybody everything. They just they like to play their cards close to the chest on these things.
Well, and what does that say towards the fact that maybe the military, especially, but the government, is hiding information, though, John, on extraterrestrial, on the extraterrestrial issue?
As a scientist.
Are they hiding?
Well, as
Go ahead,
a scientist, I'm convinced we're not alone in the universe. And reports from the UFO community and what we found on Mars merely reinforced that belief. Now, I want you to know something, Paul. There's a very important principle involved in searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, and all the people at the SETI Institute, the real mainstream people who, they're looking for radio signals. They don't want any they're not interested in crashed spaceships. They're interested in radio signals from other stars because that's very safe. If you have aliens crashing at Roswell, then that's kind of scary, and that frightens. Also, they're funded by the government, or were. So, or even now, they're probably funded by friends of the government. But the most important principle in SETI is called the principle of mediocrity. Mediocrity says that the human race and the Earth and the sun are mediocre in the universe. We're not remarkable. We're pretty much average. We are unique, just like any human being on Earth is unique from any other human being. But if you put all the human beings on Earth in a big crowd, everyone looks about average. They They have two eyes, two nose, two ears, etc. You know, you have a standard human. And the standard human being is a fairly good sample of intelligent life in the universe. And that tells you, I wrote a novel about this, a science fiction novel about the collapse of the UFO cover-up called Morningstar Pass. I wrote it under a pen name, Victor Norgaard, because I like to keep my science separate from my science fiction. And in it, the character, one of the heroines, says, she's a UFO abductee, and she says, I've met these people from outer space. She says, and this is a science fiction novel, but she says, I've met these people from outer space. The good news is that they're a lot like us. And she says, the bad news is they're a lot like us. And her family was from Ukraine and survived the Holocaust in World War II, and her grandmother fought in the Red Partisans, you know, the Red Guerrillas of the Russian army against the Germans. And so her view of human history was really rough. And if there are other people out there, please do not assume that they're far more noble than we are, or assume that they're pretty much like us. Look at the Earth, how troubled it is. If you want to know what intelligent life in the universe acts like, turn on the news. The Kardashian sisters, Iran, North Korea, those are all aspects of human behavior on Earth. You got to realize that the rest of the universe is probably a lot like this place. And that means the Defense Department worries about extraterrestrial life, just like they worry about countries on Earth.
Well, and here's another issue, and right before we go into taking phone calls tonight, let me let my listeners know. Number one, I am a Christian. I do believe in God. I don't try to force my issues on anyone. I do want people to think for themselves and make their own decisions. And the moniker for the show has always been, you will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you. Now, the point is, you know, if God created us, why wouldn't he have created more beings in the universe, you know, other than us? I mean, God is a creator.
Right.
And for what I've heard, John, if you don't mind me finishing the thought here, one of the reasons why it goes back to the Brookings Institute study that NASA commissioned back in 1958, which dealt with the possibility of interactions with an extraterrestrial culture. Now, if you remember, this particular paper study was done 10 years after the reported Roswell event.
Right.
And here's another thing. My father was a witness to the Roswell event back in 1948.
Oh.
And he went to the debris site, he and my uncle, and picked up debris. Okay.
He didn't put any of it just in his pocket, maybe for later?
Oh, he put a ton of it in his pocket, sort of my Uncle Elwood.
Ah.
And they played with that debris for years, they and their brothers and sisters.
Sure.
And he told me about, you know, the properties of it. Now, I have, you know, I'm not saying that the Roswell event was an extraterrestrial event or wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
The point I'm making is the Germans were working on disk technology even back in 1939.
That's right.
And they perfected it. And a lot of what they based their systems on was the work done by researchers such as T. Townsend Brown and others in electrogravitics, now known as subquantum kinetics.
Yep.
And even you and I, and we'll talk about this next week in more detail, but the mere fact that, you know, the Brookings Institute wrote that, you know, civilizations where there was a more advanced civilization had overpowered and taken control of the lesser advanced civilization.
Yes.
And, you know, reportedly that is what NASA and the government is afraid of if they admit that we have had contact with extraterrestrial life. They felt the Brookings Institute reported in their study that they felt like it would do damage to religion and to society in general.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that. You know, I believe that, you know, people, if they're given the right information and all, they can logically make their own minds up as to whether or not they're going to be.
I agree. I'm an Episcopalian, you know, and it doesn't bother me that there's life on other planets.
Well, people have asked me, John, and I'm tongue-in-cheek about it. Hmm. People have asked me since they found out about my father being a Roswell witness, do you believe in aliens, you know? And I tell them, hey, they cross the border every day, either mm-hmm. legally or illegally. But, you know, I am open to the thought of an extraterrestrial presence. And, you know, mainly because God, in my opinion, God may have, he was a creator. He may not have only created us. He may have created other races and other beings and other civilizations, seeded them throughout the cosmos, some being even older than the world or humanity in
yes.
the world. But the big question for me is, you know, that if there was an attack on Cydonia and they had advanced technology, it's been rumored, even talked about by Dick Hoagland and others, that we may be, pardon me, mankind, may be the descendants of the Martians. And I want to get into that with you.
Sure. I in my book, A Life and Death on Mars, we connected the evolution of life on Earth to perhaps the collapse of Martian climate, which apparently occurred, by the way, due to a large asteroid impact that occurred. It looks like Mars was very accident-prone, especially that Cydonia area. Cydonia is bracketed by a large asteroid impact, big as the one that wiped out the dinosaurs on Earth. That's about 500 miles to the east. And 500 miles to the west is this big hotspot of, it was the ground zero of this nuclear event. And so life was rough up there. And the big asteroid impact, if it had occurred on Mars and Mars had a biosphere like I propose, life-bearing meteorites carrying life spores from Mars would have landed on Earth. And there was a period on Earth called the Precambrian Explosion where there was an explosion of new life forms on Earth that's just kind of out of the blue, and perhaps it was an invasion from Mars, which means that part of our genetic heritage may be from early life on Mars mixed with early life on Earth. Now, apparently Mars and Earth both started living about the same time, right after you had liquid water. When they cooled enough to have a liquid water ocean on both planets, life apparently started. The earliest rocks they find that were laid down in water apparently have life signs on them on Earth, and the Mars meteorite ALH-8401 is very ancient and appears to have life signs in it from Mars. So life on Earth and Mars started almost simultaneously. And that means that a third source, space itself, probably seeded Mars and Earth. There's a principle called panspermia, that life originated from spores that drift between the stars. And that basically was the origin of life on Earth and Mars, was from space, which means that we're all kind of related anyway. We started with the same kind of primitive cells. And so, in that sense, I've said that part of our genetic heritage may be Martian. Now, other people, like Dick Hoagland, have proposed that this was some kind of that the Cydonia objects were not indigenous to Mars, that they were created by some people, by some interstellar colonists who had a colony on Mars, and some of them may have come to Earth. That's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. I don't favor it myself, simply because the conditions on Mars appear to have been very conducive to life, like on Earth. And it, to me, it is simpler to assume that life started on Earth and Mars about the same time, evolved to form intelligence, and that's what Cydonia represents, was a native Martian intelligence, which we called the Cydonians in the article that we wrote. But, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to say, oh, no, it was actually a Mars base from another colony. It was a colony from someplace else, and they may have colonized Earth as well. So once you have a universe with living things in it, things can get very complicated very quickly.
Well, and let me remind my listeners tonight, the toll-free call-in number is 888-627-6008. And at any time, if you want to call in, please call in, and I will interrupt, or my producer will interrupt the show and allow for the phone calls to come in for Dr. Brandenburg. Well, one other thing I was wondering, Dr. Brandenburg, is like the ancient mythos, like with Atlantis and all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about an advanced civilization in the distant past.
Yeah.
And how it destroyed itself. You know, I've always thought and taken the idea that it was based maybe partially on the truth, but over the years had been tainted. And what if the ancients were talking about Mars instead of Atlantis? About the destruction of Mars and the fact that the civilization probably knew in advance that they needed to get off the planet. And they saw this nice...
Yeah, there's a long tradition on Earth that, well, you must understand, the human race apparently has been around on Earth in its present form for about 200,000 years. And most of the history of that period is unknown. We don't know exactly what our ancestors did or what levels they have achieved. Maybe they had civilizations that rose and fell. You know, there have been recently at like Gobi Tepe in Turkey, and there's another place in Armenia where they found kind of Stonehenge-like structures that are really quite advanced and quite elaborate. They even make Stonehenge look primitive. And these things are even older than Stonehenge. So the oldest sites of civilization are almost 10,000 years old. So there's a lot of human history that we don't understand, that we don't know about. So we can't really rule out that there may have been contact with extraterrestrials in the past, advanced civilizations perhaps seeded from space or perhaps beneficiaries of technological transfer from outer space. Well, you, of course, you're aware of the the ancient Hindu holy books that are very extensive, and they talk about what sounds for all the world like a colony from outer space being established in some place in India, and them getting in, having a civil war, and ending up nuking each other, complete with mushroom clouds, sickness and strange burns afterwards, great flaming arrows that made big mushroom cloud explosions. You know, it reads just like a science fiction novel. And this is in the ancient Hindu holy books. So it looks, in fact, like there was, it looks, in fact, like a primitive person's account of watching a extraterrestrial colony come down, have things go south in the colony. The colony splits, and they end up having a civil war between two colonial centers. So it's a, like I said, it's our deep past, the deep past of the human race is a mystery. There could have been an Atlantis or something similar. Not only that, of course, you know the human race likes to tell stories and sometimes likes to embellish stories. So some of these stories may have been a little exaggerated, but at least the story from India sounds just like a science fiction novel.
Well, what about the writings of the ancient Sumerians? Sitchin.
That's right. Jeremiah Sitchin talked about the writings of the ancient Sumerians, which sounded like people from outer space came and taught them how to do things, and that the human race may have been started out as a bunch of biomechanical robots made by somebody from outer space that got ambitions of ambitions of our own. And
you know, mainly that they developed us genetically into a slave race.
Well, the history, you know, the human race kept slaves almost from its very beginning, and it may have gotten that habit from, we may have been a race of slaves at one point. Like I said, when you have a universe full of living beings like ourselves, some very complicated things can start happening. And can't remember, what did Jeremiah Sitchin say about what happened to these people who used us, who created us as slaves? Where did they go? Did they decide to just abandon the colony and leave us to our own devices?
You know, Sitchin wrote that in the text that the slaves revolted against their masters, similar to what happened. You've seen the movie Stargate?
Yes.
Similar to that, where they rose up and combated their masters, and the masters left, but they ended up firing nuclear bombs
at us after we couldn't pursue them into outer space, so they nuked the cities that we had taken over.
Yes.
Well, that sounds typically tragic. That sounds like the human race would get that in that sort of trouble. It also puts to rest this idea that everybody from outer space is sugar and spice and everything nice. I mean, that's unreasonable to expect that.
Well, let me bring this up, too. In the
sure.
ancient Sumerian text, they talked about the planet Nibiru. Now, the planet was a brown dwarf star, and the actual planet with the life forms on it that came to the to the world, to Earth, came from a moon of Nibiru.
In other words, a small planet orbiting this brown dwarf. Or,
correct.
You know, it was basically kind of a star.
Correct.
Not a very good star.
And it's been rumored that we are in a double star system. And
yeah, I've heard these rumors for a long time. The fact is, though, that such a brown dwarf would still put out a lot of heat. You know, because of the Cold War, infrared, you know, heat sensing technology has gotten very, very good. They can make infrared cameras that are, let's see, very good, and those are widely available from both the United States, the Russians, you know, the Chinese make them. Just about anybody with a good telescope could look around with one of these infrared telescopes, and they could probably find the Nibiru if it was anywhere close by. You know, they have spent a lot of time. The original planet, Neptune, well, Uranus was discovered by a British astronomer just by accident. He put up as a new telescope in his backyard and found this nice planet. And he actually named it after King George. But the astronomers persuaded him to change the name to something from Greek mythology. So he did. And then they noticed that Uranus was not moving like it should, that something was disturbing it. So then they found the planet Neptune based on the calculations of several mathematicians who looked at the disturbances of Uranus's orbit and found out that it was moving close to another body out there. You know, it's very far from the sun, so another large planet creates as much gravity as the sun does out there. And so they found the planet Neptune based on these calculations. And then they applied the same thing to Neptune. They thought Neptune was maybe not moving right. And this has led to Planet X, the idea of Planet X. Of course, they found Pluto, which they found out was such a tiny little, it's just a little snowball out there. It doesn't have enough gravity to disturb anything. And so they, in fact, it's not even considered a planet anymore. It's considered a dwarf planet. That caused a lot of trouble, by the way, when they took away Pluto's planetary status. It caused a lot of hard feelings, especially because it was an American. It was the only planet discovered by an American, and the Europeans took it away. They declared it wasn't a planet. But anyway, Neptune, the planet Neptune has always had kind of an orbit that they thought was a little strange, and that has always fueled speculation that there's something like a Nibiru out there. But that's one of those long-standing mysteries in astronomy. That's similar to the fact, you know, that the Voyager appears to have this weird acceleration towards the sun that shouldn't be there. And they can never somehow put that one to bed. It's a small effect. It's hard to measure. People argue about how it's measured. And it's just one of these controversies that goes on and on. So there could be very well a Nibiru out there, but I'm surprised. It would have to be extremely cold, though, and small.
Well, what I've heard, and it was recently made public on CNN, of all things, CNN News, that they found using the one of the orbital X-ray observatories, they found a heat signature of what they consider a brown dwarf star that's orbiting in an elongated path out through the...
I remember hearing that they thought they'd found Nibiru as an infrared, as a heat source out there in the very far outer solar system. And that would be very exciting. But then I heard other astronomers said, oh, no, these people have measured it wrong. And so it's... That's one of those controversies, like the Higgs boson, you know.
Well, the reason why I bring it up is because a lot of the scientists who are saying no are working for the U.S. government, in fact, for NASA.
Well, remember, Paul, everybody, almost all astronomers work for a government of some kind, and that's who signs their paychecks. So if the U.S. government or any other government tells an astronomer, no, you didn't actually see that, they have to tend to agree. This goes back to the old days when all astronomers were actually astrologers plotting the astrology tables of various kings and emperors. And if they found something bad in one of the astrology tables, then they just adjusted the table. So the horoscope was positive.
No, I agree with that.
So the role of astronomers to governments has really not changed at all since the early days when they were back in Babylon, when the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, would call his stargazers in and say, well, what's my horoscope today? And they'd all say, oh, it's real good.
He's doing good, sir. We don't want our heads being chopped off. So,
that's
yeah,
right.
Well.
I taught an astronomy course, and I got a good laugh out of my students by saying that I was actually, in one of my earlier reincarnations, I was actually the court astronomer for Pharaoh of Egypt, Pharaoh Ramses, and we're standing there on the edge of the Nile. I remember standing at the edge of the Nile with Pharaoh Ramses one day, and Pharaoh Ramses turns to me and says, "Oh, John of Brandenburg, what is at the center of the universe?" And I instantly replied, "Pharaoh, it's you. You're the center of the universe, as far as I'm concerned." So you got to remember that all astronomers, if the government, if the astronomers report something and the government doesn't like it, then the astronomers tend to change their reports because they want to keep their jobs. And I wrote another novel about what would really happen if there was a big asteroid on a collision course with Earth. And what happens is the government finds out the government is the first ones to figure out that there's that this newly discovered asteroid is going to hit Earth. And the public doesn't hear anything about it for a long time. Because I worked in Washington, D.C. for about 15 years. I know how this government works, and I was part of the mission to the moon, the Clementine mission. And, the government handles things dealing with outer space in a certain way. And if you're going to work in that business, you learn very quickly, you have to do things the way Uncle Sam likes. And one of the things is that if you see something strange or interesting, Uncle Sammy gets to know about it first, and then he decides whether it's going to be made public.
Well, do you mind if I could ask you, before we have to end the show tonight, on the mm-hmm. Clementine mission, did you see anything in the photographs, or even in the spectral analysis as well as mm-hmm. the X-ray analysis on the moon that would indicate, and I've read that there may be, and even Dick Hoagland states that there may have been artificial structures on the moon.
Well, there are a lot of public, a lot of the pictures, especially in Lunar Orbiter, which was earlier. Well, first let me directly answer your question. I never saw anything. But I only saw probably one picture out of a million. A lot of the pictures were diverted to a tightly guarded part of the project where they did all the picture analysis. We basically got to see some pictures on the big movie, on the big mission screen, basically because we could monitor the spacecraft's health. It was sending down pictures. It was operating like it should. But all we saw was just a bunch of craters and things like that. There have been reports that there are things on the far side of the moon that look artificial, and that would be entirely consistent with the UFO activity. If the UFO is extra, anyway, it's a. I didn't see anything, and several people have asked me that, and I can honestly say I didn't see anything. And so it's a quite fascinating.
Well, and you brought up the point about the far side of the moon, and it's been rumored very heavily that the Department of Defense may have launched from a Pacific launch site Apollo-derived missions after the Apollo 17,
mm-hmm.
the far side of the moon.
Well, remember the Apollo missions use a Saturn V rocket, and it's almost impossible to disguise the launch of a Saturn V. It takes a big thing. Now, they probably launched a lot of... the lunar orbiter missions, which orbited the moon, all of that technology was derived from spy satellite technology. They basically did a photo reconnaissance of the moon. And if there's any signs of somebody else on the moon, it's in the lunar orbiter picked it up, because it was based on satellites that were mapping all the military installations in Russia during the Cold War. So there's a, if I'm in the Defense Department and I'm doing my job, then one of the things I do is I find out if there's anyone else on the moon, and I find out where all of their stuff is. And that's my job. If I'm sitting at the moon desk at the Pentagon, that's what I do. And that's my job.
Well, the reason why I bring it up is that there may be some credence to the rumors. The reason why is because Apollo 17 was supposed to be followed by Apollos 18, 19, and 20.
Yes.
What happened was they had flight-ready hardware. It was already paid for. Now, they reported, and if I understand correctly, because I used to study up on Apollo when I was younger, they generally had enough money to make two of everything.
Yes.
Two sets of everything they did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 20, they had a backup system and a primary launch vehicle, a backup and primary. Same as with the Apollo Command Module, Service Module, and Lunar Module. Now, the museum pieces, I believe, were the backup systems.
Sure.
That we're currently seeing at the Johnson Space Center, Kennedy, and Marshall Space Flight Center. Now, reportedly, the Saturn V may have been launched on an atoll in the South Pacific. That was
that would be a major construction project. However, if the U.S. government really wanted to do that, it could have done it. It would have been quite an adventure. The problem with going to the far side of the moon, by the way, is that when you land, is you're out of radio contact with the Earth. And all the Apollo landings were right on the front side near the equator, so they could have really good radio contact with the Earth. And
from what I heard, though, John, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're getting close at
a great pleasure to be on your show.
Okay, but the one thing I wanted to bring up real quickly is the fact that they had perfected small miniature communication satellites that would always have point of view or line of sight with the others. To triangulation technique,
sure.
To where they could use one primary system and the two backups to send the signal even from the far side of the moon back to Earth in real time.
Sure.
And if they did that, then it would have made perfect sense. And if that were the case, one of the first books written about this in a fictional manner was the book by James Michener, Space.
Yes, I remember that.
He talked about an Apollo 18.
Yes, he did.
And you know what he claimed about it?
What?
He claimed that all his information in there was factual. Certain things.
Well, it ended quite tragically, though. The as I remember in his book, the two of the Apollo astronauts were stranded on died on the moon due to a solar flare.
Well, and he stated something in an interview before he died that he kind of fictionalized that particular point. That there was something that happened that even if he could talk about it, no one would believe it.
Well,
so he kind of kept...
Sure.
And it goes back to the Apollo 20 videos that were released that they may have found a crashed mothership of an extraterrestrial origin on the far side of the moon. And that was both a... go ahead, please.
Oh, no. I'm just saying, well, that's entirely possible. If we landed on the moon six times that we know of, we could have landed more if we wanted to.
That it was a combined effort between the Russian government or the Soviet government and the U.S. to investigate this anomaly.
Ah, well, on matters like that, the Russian and the American governments would, of course, cooperate as a matter of mutual defense. And so it's quite possible.
Okay, we're
in
about
the universe
to end the show.
With intelligent life in it. What's that?
Okay, we're about to end the show. And could you tell the listeners where they can find your book?
Well, Amazon.com, and they're published by Adventures Unlimited. And one is Life and Death on Mars, the New Mars Synthesis, and the other is Beyond Einstein's Unified Field, Electromagnetism and Gravity Redefined, where I lay out the theory of unifying the fields and the result, a craft to use this for propulsion looks like a flying saucer.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that next week on part two of the interview, and I want to tell everybody, I'd like to thank my listeners tonight. And if you want to know more about me, go to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/PaulPrice1968, or go to my MySpace page, which is myspace.com/The Prophecy Chronicle Show, which is one of my former shows. But that has up-to-date information on my new ventures at this point. And if you want to know anything about alternative health, please go to isogenics.com/Paul Richard Price, and you'll see that and maybe buy some product. And I've written a book called The Annie Sung, The Prophecy Chronicles, Chronicle 2. You can buy it from Amazon.com. And join the affiliate program here on BBS. You'll help support my show that way, and you'll get great archives of the show. And I'd like to thank tonight's producer and BBS Radio, and we will see you next week. You will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you. Paul Price, signing off for tonight.
Very
good,
everyone.